Good morning and welcome back to Nach Yomi. Today we are going to be learning together Daniel, Perek Vov, the sixth chapter of the book of Daniel. This is arguably the most famous chapter in the book of Daniel, and it is the associations in this Perek which give us the image we have of Daniel today. Our Perek is made up of 29 psukim, and it should really be read as a contrast and comparison to Perek Gimel. As a reminder, Perek Gimel was when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were forced to confront a very difficult decision, and that is whether they were going to support their religious beliefs and not bow down to the statue or be thrown into the kiln of fire. They decided to stay with their religious beliefs. They were thrown into the fire. They were protected by an angel. They escaped unscathed, and the king Nebuchadnezzar was so in wonder and awe of them that he wrote an edict to his people about respecting the nation of Israel. So we're going to see a very similar pattern unfold in our Perek, because this is the Perek of Daniel in the lion's den. Let's look at it in micro sections and consider a few points to ponder on each. The first is the first three psukim, in which we're discussing now a new king. Up till now, we've met Nebuchadnezzar, we've spent some time with Belshazzar, now we're spending some time with Darius, Darius Hamadai, which is the Median Darius. There's going to be a second Darius later on, the Persian. That's not the one. This is the first now after the transition of power. We're told that he's 62 years old at the time of assuming leadership, and he establishes 120 Achashtar Panaya, which are governors or satraps over his kingdom. And above them, he has three heads. So these are the 120 Achashtar Panim are reporting to the three heads, and Daniel is one of them. They deal with the governors so that the king does not have to worry. Malko lo lehevei nozek. The king should not be damaged or worried. So just what are these Achashtaranim? What exactly are their roles? What do they do? We know this word from the Megillah. It's a Persian word. Satraps is the way it's translated in English, if that is English. And the question is, what exactly is going on here? So the Malbim explains that these are actually Persian overseers to local governments. So when the Persians conquered and continued to expand their conquest, they took over natural cultures around them, but they did not necessarily overthrow or do a complete overhaul and destroy everything, as the Da'at Mikra points out. They wanted to nurture the individual cultures that they had taken over, but they had overseers who are Persian who would check and see that loyalty was in fact true. The job of these people was also to give advice to the king about what was going on in the locale and how to save him from any damage, which explains the words "Deloy lehevi nizok," that he should not be damaged. So they would be the, so to speak, the ear on the ground to know what was going on the local politics level. The second section of the Perek is Psukim Dalad to Vov, 4 to 6, in which Daniel is now distinguished among those three heads of state. Wherever he goes, he brought success, and whatever he did, the king was so happy with him, he wanted to promote him over the entire empire. So Daniel is essentially the second most important person in the entire Persian and known world at this point in time. And of course, when one person succeeds, and certainly if that person is a Jew, that brings about jealousy. And so the other heads, the other satraps grew jealous. They wanted to find fault with him in any way they could, but they could not. He was not late to work. He was not disingenuous. He did not set up funds in the Cayman Islands. He was a honest person. He was a very loyal citizen. There was nothing they could find which would bring any of his work in question. And the only thing they could see was that he was Jewish, which leads them to hatch a terrible plot. Psukim Zion to Yud. In this section now, they plot and they come to the king and they said, "Oh, king, live. Malka la'olamin chaya, let the long live the king." And they say, "You know, we've all of your advisors, O king, have come up with the most wonderful law that we think you should sign. And that is, for 30 days, everybody should give allegiance to the king and ask him for things. And anybody who turns to any other power in the world, asks for any favor from anybody or anything else, should be thrown into the den of the lions." The king agrees and signs the edict. Quick question, what exactly is this whole business 30 days? Why would the king agree to something which sounds so strange? So Ibn Yahya, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Yahya, explains that this would be a demonstration by of themselves, they, to show their own allegiances. They say, O king, we want to show in our own lives how important you are, that we would never ask a favor from anybody else. And the impression of these 30 days will express itself in the rest of our lives as your loyal servants. So a good amount of flattery does help any person, certainly leaders. The Bible now says it's a little more complex. He says that this is the beginning of the rule of Darius. And remember, Darius is taking over from an assassination of Belshazzar. And at this point in time, he is trying to establish himself. And they're saying, look, the point is let's set the stage right for the beginning of your service. In fact, the Malbim explains that it's more complex than that. It's not just that the focus of the decree is not so much about the other people, the other beings, not being addressed as means to an end. But rather, the point was like this. It was that for 30 days, now people would come to the king, and he would have an open office, and any requests they had, he would grant. So the main focus was, so to speak, in a Godfather-like-esque scene, everybody's coming to Darius, the great provider, the great merciful king. But should you forfeit that and ask anybody or anyone else, that's when you're forfeit. So they made it, framed it in a positive way, but the negative side was, so to speak, almost an addendum, when in fact it was their main purpose. This now, the Al-Sheikh also points out that it was presented as if it was all of them. They said, oh, all of us, all the advisors. Notice, of course, Daniel was not there because he was one of the prime advisors, but they made it presented as if it was all of them. And a lot of times, whenever you want to try to pull the wool over somebody's eyes, you over-exaggerate, you generalize, and this was certainly not everybody. It was a lot of discontented, jealous advisors, but it was certainly not all of them. Which moves us to Psukim Yud Aleph, to Yud Ches, the fourth section. And in this section, we hear that Daniel, immediately hearing about this decree of the king, goes to his house and heads up to his attic, where he has windows open towards Jerusalem. And that would be the place where he would daven for three times a day. He would bow down to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the people realized, they came and they burst and they congregated and they saw that he was davening, and they brought him before the king and they said, O king, you have an edict that anybody who would pray or ask of any other deity or power other than you should be killed. Is it not in the edict? And the king reiterated that it was in the edict, but he was had a very hard time. He loved Daniel dearly, so he tried all night to prevent Daniel being executed, but there was no point, as they pointed out, that edict signed by the king, even the king himself can't overturn something. We'll see later on in Megillas Esther, historically, where Achashverosh cannot return the edict of the destruction of the Jews. Just the same, obviously, legal system over here about the king's edicts. And so you have no choice but to throw Daniel or drop Daniel into the den of lions. It seems it's a pit in the ground. They had a small aperture at the top, and he said to Daniel as he was lowered in, he says, may the God who you serve save you now. And they put a large stone over the pit, and they sealed it with the king and the courtiers' signatures. And it talks about how the king fasted that entire night. A few points just to notice over here is, why did Daniel go to daven right now? He couldn't wait just a little longer. After all, you know, there are certain mitzvahs for which a person needs to put their life down for if they were forced to with a gun to their temple. But davening is not one of them. They are the Avodah Zarah, Shvichus Damim, and Gilui Arayos, the three cardinal sins, right? Adultery, and murder. But he was not being asked to do any one of these three. So Daniel, just take it easy. Why is he going to do something which is essentially putting himself on the runaway track, on the railway tracks? So Al-Sheikh says, no. He used to daven publicly in a minyan. You think Daniel davened all the time at home? It wasn't COVID season. What was going on? So the point was, he usually davened in the Beis Medrash. Once he heard this edict, he went home. And in fact, that's why it says that he was bowing down, because the Al-Sheikh explains in his Pirush Chavatzelus HaSharon, he was lowering himself in a way that he could not be seen through the windows. A lot of interesting halachas of davening are learnt from this description about how one faces Yerushalayim, the windows in a shul. A lot of interesting discussions halachically appear from here. The Malbim goes on to add that in fact, he believed that the gzeira of the king was about asking specific things from a deity or from a person. But here in this case, he wasn't. He davened three times a day. So he believed that this was not in fact part of what the king's gzeira was. The king's gzeira was specific requests. He davened three times thrice daily, independent of whether he had a specific request. How do they know that he prayed? Chida points out that they surrounded the house. And they found somebody, a young lady who worked in the house, and asked her, and they took her evidence and used that. Sounds very much like Inquisition-esque type of evidence. You know, hearsay evidence, which is enough to bring that to judgment. Why do they seal the stone? Like, why they got him in the lion's den? There are hungry lions down there. Why do they need to have the seal? So the Rashi says, so they wanted to make sure the king would not change his mind. They wanted him to, so to speak, ratify this. The Bible says, no, the king was doing this to protect Daniel, so they could not throw anything in on him, so that he would only be with the lions who he believed Daniel would be protected for, as he says to Daniel. But he didn't want any human agency to, God forbid, do this, because a human agency could potentially upset even a divine plan. Fascinating discussion in and of itself. And why was the king so concerned? Why was he fasting at night? The Zohar HaKadosh explains that this might be a metaphor for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even when HaKadosh Baruch Hu decrees upon people who are less than worthy to be punished, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, fasts. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is pained by having to execute such judgments. We now move to the fifth section, Psukim Chav to Chav Hei, in which the miracle occurs. At dawn, the king rushed out at Bechipazon to see Daniel, but Behelta. And as he approached, he calls out in a sad voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, did your God save you from the lions? And Daniel calls out and he says, King of the world, live. Ambiguous where he's referring to Dariavesh or to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, my God sent me an angel and protected me and closed the mouths of the lions. They didn't harm me because I was righteous. And I was righteous in front of you, O king, and I never did you harm. Pointing out that he was being framed for something which was illegitimate. And that the king was so excited, he pulled Daniel out of the pit, and true to his words, there was not a single bodily injury upon Daniel. He then commanded to take those who slandered Daniel and threw them and their families into the pits of the lions, and describes that the lions were so hungry that before they even reached the bottom of the pit, they had not only were they consumed, their bones were ground up by the lions. That's how severe it was. We're talking about the Asiatic lion, a lion which is now actually extinct in the natural habitat in the Iranian area, the Persian area today. The Asiatic lion was very much a prominent symbol, if you know, even on the Iranian flag from the Safavid dynasty just before, until the Shah was deposed of. The lion was one of the symbols of the Iranian or the Persian Empire for many, many, many centuries. Point to ponder is how does this actually happened, how the miracle occurred. Sadia Gaon explains that the angel appeared as the form of a more powerful and terrifying lion right next to him, which scared off even these hungry creatures. It is interesting to me that the notion of their bones being ground up, it relates to that idea of rekev atzamois kina, that the idea of jealousy is something which will ultimately grind down your bones, and that's literally what happened to these jealous people, these Jew-hating, jealous people who couldn't stand Daniel in his loyalty, rising the ranks in the king's palace. Finally, the parak concludes with a letter sent by the king from Sukkim Chavov to Lamed, and he writes a very beautiful letter to command all his people to fear the God of Daniel. And he says that Hashem's limits have no bounds, there's no horizon, there's no lack to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power, as is seen by the Daniel being saved by the lion. Daniel then lived and prospered under Darius and Cyrus the Great. Quick question is, how long did he live under the reign of Cyrus? In the first parak, we're told that he was under Cyrus for 1 year. So the Malbim explains that that was in his employ. That was when he actually served him. But Daniel asked for a retirement after too many of these complicated experiences. Daniel asked to retire. He went to Shushan and he lived out his years in prosperity there. What is interesting is that the significance of this letter that he sends. What is the significance of it? So the Malbim explains that this is going to be the precursor to the return of Jews to the province of Judea. This is going to be what sets into motion the allowance of the Jews being legitimized and having their homeland. This is a very crucial moment in what we'll call the national mechanisms of Geula. And it also is interesting to me, it probably also set into motion the ideas of later anti-Semites like Haman continually having a chip on their shoulder that all these kings had recognized the Jews as well in such a unique fashion. This concludes Perek Vav. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.